From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley, and we have three guests joining us this morning, and we have a couple in studio, which is so wonderful. I love having a full studio. First up, we're going to be talking with Susan Cordone, who is Park City's conservation coordinator. Susan is going to be describing the city's landscape incentive program and how homeowners and HOAs could be eligible to receive up to $3 per square foot of grass removed and replaced by native plants and grasses. That's in the first part of the program.
Then we'll speak with Tracy Harden with the nonprofit Citizens Climate Lobby. CCL is hosting a candidate forum for those individuals running for Summit County Council and the state legislature. The questions and topics will focus on the environment and will be held next Tuesday, October 8th, at the Santee Auditorium. We'll give you additional details in the second part of the show.
And then, this is exciting, we have not so much a blast from the past, a recent past. You are going to recognize this name. We're going to spend a few minutes with Nell Larson, who was the director of Swanner Eco Center and Nature Preserve, and co-host of This Green Earth for years. And the three of us have worked together. We are going to maybe go down a little bit of memory lane and then talk about what Nell is up to these days. She is now working down in Los Alamos, New Mexico. She's going to share with us some of that and also the environmental and cultural beauty of Los Alamos and what's happening in the Santa Fe area in New Mexico that might also be similar to some of the things that we're dealing with here. The first that we want to talk to this morning is Susan Cordone, who is Park City's conservation coordinator. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Let's first talk about your background a little bit, Susan. You've been with the city for about 2 years, you said, and what your role is now with them.
That's fantastic. I love to share, and being in studio is also fantastic because everyone here is very smiley. So I can tell there's a combined passion for water savings here and for the earth. As far as my background, I came to Park City Municipal Water Department after working for many years in a large California water agency, supporting conservation solely for both Northern and Southern California. So it was a big job and helped me to understand, obviously, the importance for each and every one of us to save water. I mean, it's really upon all of us, and as individuals, as well as cities, corporations, it just goes on and on forever. But it really starts with us. So I'm here to kind of share my passion with water conservation with our community.
You are obviously coming to a place, a state, and an area that is quite arid, and we've been having some problems in this area. What are some of the things that you saw when you came into this position that struck you most?
Well, the area was just kind of coming out of a drought, if you will, and so it gave me the opportunity to sort of assess what was going on as far as the mindset of folks. I mean, obviously, we know this community is absolutely gorgeous and very, very green. And so that is certainly a mindset. We love that. It's beautiful. But it's something that I'd like to maybe help incentivize as far as my passion for water conservation, help customers understand that, you know, we don't necessarily need all the turf that we have here in our community. Is it non-functional? Probably. Some of it is, some of it isn't. Mm. So it's looking at, well, what are we using and what are we not using? And then go from there.
And yeah, as you're calculating this, we had talked a little bit earlier, and I loved this term, the trifecta of knowledge, and how you believe people are intaking knowledge about water conservation. Can you share that with us?
Sure. My feeling is that water conservation as a mindset is it's device driven, it's behavioral, and then when you add data into that, you really have a trifecta. You can start to make decisions about your water use, whether it's at home, at work, or in our community, with knowledge. You know, knowledge is power, right? And so you can, the trifecta really, you can put a new smart controller in, But if you don't actually monitor it, keep your eyes on it, understand what it's doing to benefit you as far as ease and convenience, it's not a set it and forget it type situation. You have to have the behavior and the desire to make sure that that controller is controlled. You have control. So it's just sort of a mindset. You know, use your own behavior and passion for water conservation. Add in devices. Look at your data. That's where you progress, in my opinion.
Well, let's talk about the landscape incentive program, which may include those three elements too. Describe what the program is about and who might take advantage of it.
Sure. The program is really for all Park City customers. And I'll talk about Park City first, because of course that's where we are, that's where I work, and I represent Park City Municipal. So a single family residential, homeowners association, and even our commercial properties, you know, if our larger hotels have a big, you know, back 40 and they want to, they find that it's non-functional and they're not using it, they would also be eligible. So really, everybody here in Park City is eligible for this program. If you are an owner and the renters that are here, we have those as well. Just talk to your owner and say, hey, we're not using the backyard. I'd like to reduce the water use. And so they apply for it by going to parkcity.org.
Okay.
You can type in landscape incentive program. And all the details are there.
So now, describe what we mean by non-functional turf.
Okay.
You know, and versus, say, functional turf. Where do we draw the lines there?
Sure, that's a good question.
Right.
Non-functional is just, I mean, it's just we're looking at it, right? We're not using it. We're not playing on it. I like to say our dogs aren't pooping on it, you know, it's just non-functional.
Mm-hmm.
Although some would say that is functional,
sure.
Right?
Sure.
So it's just, you know, a large, you know, square footage of
grass.
Grass.
Let's get to it. This is focused on turf, meaning grass,
right?
Which is in many ways the grass we grow around here is non-native.
Correct, usually,
right?
Yes.
So Kentucky bluegrass or other forms of bluegrass or grass like that.
Right.
So that's what the program is aimed at, because that type of grass, I'll jump in, is it can use a lot of water.
It's very
water
thirsty.
Loving. It's very thirsty. And then it can also require fertilizer in the spring or so. That gets applied.
Mm-hmm.
I know where I live in Ratcliffe Village, it has to get then mowed.
Right.
And trimmed. And God forbid, of course, the grass sweepings have to be blown with blowers all over the place. Don't get me started on that.
Okay.
So there's a lot of things that go on that involve not just water, but energy.
Indeed.
To maintenance and maintain. So this is an opportunity to look at your grass in your yard or in your HOA or, like you say, commercial property, and see opportunities to reduce that.
Indeed, yes.
Okay.
We love our citizen scientists, too, people who take interest and learn more, like you talked about the data or how they intake it, and then want to help. And this is a community that wants to help. So give us an example of if someone did sign up for this, what does that mean? Do they remove the grass themselves and then they get paid? How does it work?
That's a great question as well. So, yeah, it's self-serve, really. I mean, you do apply. Please, I just want to caution the audience out there, if you're interested, don't put a spade into the ground until you get approved, because I want to really manage expectations there. Excuse me.
That's all I'm going to say. Mm-hmm. Approved for the program. I mean, you can put a spade in the ground and do it yourself.
Of course.
But if you want to apply for the incentive, the financial rebate, you have to have a plan first.
Definitely.
Okay.
Thanks for clarifying. Yes, you definitely have to have a plan. There's a fair bit of research. So, you know, you really want to have the excited person in the family go after it, right? And dig into the plants that are available for use, which there is a list on our parkcity.org website. And they include basically an, you know, overarching low water use, of course, some native are in the list, of course, as well as fire resistant. So that is unique to the Park City area, where our mayor and city council decided to add in that particular caveat, which I think is a very, very good. And so it just adds a different component, an additional component to look for the plants that are appropriate and available for use within this program. So you're making a plan, you're picking some plants, you're looking at the area in which you would like to remove the turf. And of course, the very first thing really is reaching out and requesting a meeting. And that meeting is a site visit, and that's done with me. So I do some consulting at the time. So it's pretty good, and it's comprehensive. I answer a lot of questions while we're walking around folks' properties. So it's great. It's my favorite part of the job, actually.
That layer of wildfire mitigation is so important. It's something that we talk about here a lot, and to have that be part of your incentive. If you do have some issues, the property that you back up to, if you put this into use, it could help protect your property. Sure. So it's $3 per square foot of grass. That's the incentive that you get. So is there any cap on that?
Yes. Yeah, good. That's another great question. Mm-hmm. You guys have got the good ones. So for single family residential, it's $15,000 per for each property. So, and then for commercial HOAs, it does go up to $75,000.
So $75,000, rough math, at $3 per square foot. That could account for up to 25,000 square feet at, say, an HOA.
Correct.
If they have that. Going back to the plan, is there a checklist or something that the city says, okay, in your plan, we want to see drawings, and we want to see some type of narrative explaining what you're going to do, and we want to, of course, see the list of plants. I just want to know more about what do I need to submit, and who do I submit that to?
Sure, that's good. So you start with the website. The website's going to invite you to meet with me.
Okay.
Site visit,
right.
And I'm going to talk to you about your plan. And we actually did this, so that's great.
Yes, at Ratcliffe Village.
Yeah. Right. And then the plan does not need to be, you know, a full landscape architectural rendering.
Good point.
It could be a homeowner's design.
It could literally be, I could draw something on a piece of engineering paper and say, this is what we're going
to
do.
It doesn't even have to be on engineering paper, but yes, you can.
And it doesn't have to be signed by a professional architect or landscaper.
That's right.
What I wanted to make sure.
That's right.
Okay.
However, I just want to add the caveat to that. It will be going to our city planning department for review. And that is an important step to ensure that the plans that our homeowners or our HOAs are making are in compliance with the plans for the city, the landscape ordinance, the way we want our aesthetics in our beautiful little town to be, right?
Is there a minimum of how many square feet? Let's say I have a small backyard. It's
250 square feet.
250
yep.
square
So that's
feet
your minimum.
Is the minimum. Okay.
Yes.
Good.
So I'm going to jump in and ask a question.
Nell.
Yeah, come
mind.
On in, Nell.
Get
the
band
back warm.
Together. So I think it's such a cool benefit that you actually do a site visit with the people that are applying for this. I'm curious, what are the most common questions or issues you get on those visits that people are asking you about?
A lot of people are unsure about how to remove turf. There are a variety of ways that you can do. Depends on the timing, how quickly you're going to do your project. The plant list is definitely a hot topic because of our unique sort of our altitude and the way plants grow here. Mm. So I always suggest that folks, walk around, look at plants that are thriving in the neighborhoods. Plants they love, take pictures of them, see if they're on the list, see if they're low water use and fire resistant.
Plants and trees, shrubs.
Correct.
Does that include aspens?
I don't think so.
Okay, it's important because people are saying, I'm going to just cut out my grass and plant aspens. That's not necessarily an acceptable trade.
No, there are definitely the customers need to comply with the landscape ordinance. And
it's interesting because that's a native.
Indeed.
That's an example of a native plant or tree that may not be most acceptable for this program or the goals and objectives you're looking for.
I would say so, yes.
Okay.
Again, where can people go to find out more information? And is it becoming busy? Is it, you know, a couple days out, a couple weeks out that they can expect to hear back from you?
Well, I mean, folks are turning off their irrigation.
Right.
I'm happy to go and do site walks and site visits, you know, a couple of weeks. Advance notice is great, and just reach out to, you can also email savewater at parkcity.org. That's another one. Our email for our water department is water@parkcity.org. If you've got additional questions, I do want to add, though, if you don't mind, this program is not just for Park City Municipal. The state is run, this is a statewide and is being offered in a variety of different communities throughout the state. Not every single community is offering, not every community has a landscape ordinance. So it's something that I know your listeners are not right here 100%. You've got Wasatch County, you've got all of Summit County and beyond. Well, heck, we might have international listeners here, right?
Yes.
Streaming.
Yes.
So it's for the state of Utah, you can look up Utah Water Savers and find additional rebates that are available.
Is there a deadline when you have to apply by?
Sure. It's not an apply by. It's until funds are depleted. But if you were to, say, apply tomorrow, go through the process of, you know, submitting your plans. Once you're approved, you have 12 months to complete your project. And the funding is held for you for that 12-month period.
Okay.
So,
And again, going back to the plan, you say you submit the plan and it's going to get reviewed by the plan. So that can take a week or two.
Sure, yes.
Right? It takes a little time. And they'll come back with comments.
They might.
They probably will.
They might.
And then you have to address that. So, so I just want to get a full idea of how long what the process is about, because people may look at this and say, well, it's not worth the time or so.
Well, Chris, it's a variable.
You're right.
Yes. It's definitely a variable. It depends on the customer. It depends on the level of detail in their plans.
Exactly. And how much grass they're looking to remove or set a time. Okay. We got to wrap up.
Really?
Yes.
The time went by so fast.
That's always
our
goal.
Why was I nervous a little
bit? I hope you weren't at all.
And
that was great.
We'll have you back anyway.
Sure.
I'd
love that.
Like you say, the program, you know, it's winding down. It's fall and winter. But you can still apply.
I would just like to ask your listening audience, if they are thinking about it, to start planning now. Reach out and let's talk. You know, let's
do the planning part now during the winter.
Totally.
Perfect.
You can do that research, pick out your plants, and then come spring, you're ready to rock.
Yep.
Yes.
All right, that website one more time.
Parkcity.org, and then you can go to the search key and type in landscape incentive program, or, you know, any other queries or questions you have about our wonderful water department, you can reach out to us at water@parkcity.org.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. That's Susan Cordon for Park City's Conservation Coordination at our own municipality right up those stairs there. We get to stare at that beautiful building every day. We appreciate you guys up there. Tell us who our next guest is, Chris.
Okay. Nell, do you want to do that?
Yeah, pass over that script.
No, you're not doing it. I'll do it. It's Tracy Harden with the Citizens Climate Lobby, and she's here to talk about the CCL's hosting a candidate forum next Tuesday, the 8th. I know there's a candidate forum tonight, but this is a candidate forum that's going to be held next Tuesday, the 8th, October 8th, and Tracy is here to talk about some of the particulars about that forum. Tracy, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you, Chris and Claire. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so let's dig into some of the details. talk about the forum and, like I say, the location, time, and what the topic will be about.
Sure. So we're meeting at the Jim Santee Auditorium at the Park City Library next Tuesday evening from 6 to 7:30. We have our candidates running for county council that will be present, as well as two that are running for House seats at the Utah Legislature that will be joining us. And we're going, our goal is to help our voters understand what our candidates' positions are on issues that impact our climate, environment, mm-hmm. livability in Summit County.
Right. And so, as I understand it, you just mentioned that there's two seats that are being vied for in Summit County Council, and that one is seat C, so that would be Megan McKenna and Ari Ioannidis, who are running against each other for seat C, and then seat A, which is Roger Armstrong's current seat, and he's running against Tori Welch. And then you said there was two Utah House of Representatives who will be joining in on the conversation or the forum, and that's Julie Monahan, I believe, with running for the seat of District 59 in District 59, sure. And the sure. and District 4's House of Representatives is Chris Campbell will be there.
That's correct.
Okay, so those are the individuals that are going to be there. And like you say, it's focused on questions that will be asked of them with respect to climate-related issues or in the environment in general. So can you give us a sense of what the topics might be in
sure.
those areas? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we're trying to, our attempt is to bring the impacts of what climate change is down to a local level, because, you know, it really, climate change, all of it is influenced at a local level. So we are going to be talking about, or with the candidates, questions relating to reducing our traffic. What are some ideas and means to reduce traffic mm-hmm. coming in and out of Park City from an emission standpoint, but it also has a big impact on our livability.
Right.
Affordable housing will also impact the number of people who are commuting in and out of town. We're going to talk a little bit about the new program on trying to reduce methane gas coming out of our landfill via the food waste management that the Park City Community Foundation Climate Fund has initiated,
right.
and the impacts of that on us. And then others on a bigger picture on a state level, water resource management, impacts to the Great Salt Lake, air quality, and home and building energy usage. So we've got a span of topics to really try to address with them within an hour to figure, or for the audience to understand how these candidates feel about these issues, what their priorities are, and hopefully learn from them what creative solutions they might have to bring to the table.
Okay, so what is the plan for asking questions? Will it be a panel asking questions, or will it be the audience participation? How might that unfold?
Sure. Well, Chris, we have you as invited you to be our moderator.
That's right.
Moderator. And we are forming questions. It's a group effort between Citizens Climate Lobby, this Green Earth, and Emily Quinton at the county is also giving us some perspective from the county and some of the issues that would be interesting to probe with them. And so collectively, we are doing our research, going more in depth in these to be able to ask the candidates really hopefully pertinent questions, and that will stimulate some good conversation.
Okay. And then there will be opportunity for the audience to ask questions?
That's correct. The last 30 minutes we're reserving for audience questions. They'll be able to submit them in writing, you know, and hopefully we have time to get to all of them, but we will prioritize them. If, you know, people are asking similar questions, we'll just combine the answers, or the questions.
Okay, right. And Will the candidates have an opportunity to maybe provide an opening statement or a closing statement or something that introduces themselves?
Oh, absolutely. So that will a brief opening statements for them, and they'll be able to make a concluding statement. And then we're trying to develop some questions that are specific to the candidate and what we have observed them stating on their platform. Mm-hmm. To be able to address and probe them a little bit more on that. And then also giving their opponents a chance to respond to their statements.
Right. Now, although with respect to the House of Representatives, the individuals running for those two districts, Julie Monahan is the Democrat, Chris Campbell is the Democrat, running for districts 59 and 4 respectively. Will the Republican candidates be appearing at the forum?
Well, the Republican candidates have been invited, and yes. Kira Berkland is the Republican incumbent running against, or that Julie Monahan is running against. Interestingly, Kira will be over in Germany doing touring to understand how Germany is applying regenerative agricultural practices in that country. So we won't be able to have her participate in the debate, but she sends her regret.
And right.
I'm hoping we'll be able to host her to learn about what she discovered in Germany. And then Mike Kohler, unfortunately, has not responded to requests to participate. We've reached out to him on numerous occasions.
Right. Okay. So they're not there, but like you say, they've been asked, and maybe they'll show up between now and then.
Well,
you don't know.
Well, if people don't attend or can't be there, is there a way to get a recording, or is there a way to get this information after the fact, or do you need to be there live to get this information?
You know, we are not planning on recording it, so it is an in-person event.
Right. Okay. So last couple minutes or so, give us a little background on Citizens Climate Lobby. Why are you doing this? You know, what is CCL all about?
Sure, thanks for asking. Citizens Climate Lobby is a national organization made up primarily of volunteers throughout the nation, and we're organized by local chapters. But at the heart of it, what Citizens Climate Lobby does is lobby our Senate and House representatives. So in our case, we've got our two Utah senators and then our four House of Representatives. And we speak to them about legislation that is either they're trying to get on the docket or is already in process, and bringing them to the table and helping to advocate for climate change in some of the bills. So for example, if it's a farm bill, if it's big wires, which is a transmission, trying to get more electrical transmission throughout the nation to support our transition from fossil fuels over to electric. The Prove It Act for carbon border adjustments. So we choose usually about four of these pillars that we want to focus on every year at a national level, and we lobby. And then we also kind of bring it to a local level, because this is where, like I started to say, it all begins at the local level.
Right.
And so getting our local candidates to a forum in which we can discuss impacts for climate change is also part of what the Wasatch Pact chapter strives to do.
And like you alluded to, Tracy, all of the topics that you kind of highlighted as might be discussed are interlinked in a way that they all affect the environment and climate in one form or another. But there's linkages there. Like you say, traffic reduction is associated, has a connection with affordable housing. And affordable housing has a connection with building energy efficiency. And food waste and other waste management plays a role in our landfill filling up and the requirement for a new cell. And the cost associated with that, and you know, what's amazing is that a drop of water that lands on Main Street here has the potential to end up in Great Salt Lake. So what we do here to conserve our water usage and protect our water quality can have a bearing on watersheds or bodies of water downstream all the way down to the Great Salt Lake. So there's a lot of connections between one environmental issue and another.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and Chris, I'll just take that a little bit further. When we look at what our carbon footprint is here locally and what we do, what cars we're driving in commuting time, how our homes are heated, our greenhouse gas emissions are also contributing to global climate change, and the drought that we're experiencing here in Utah is impacting the Great Salt Lake. So these is all interconnected. When we go down to Salt Lake in the wintertime and we can't breathe, or those with asthma are suffering, you know, we all have a hand in this. So understanding that connectivity and moving towards some climate action is what Citizens Climate Lobby is striving to do.
All right. Again, it's a candidate forum being hosted by Citizens Climate Lobby next Tuesday, October 8th at the Jim Santee Auditorium. It starts at 6. There will be questions come from a panel from hopefully for an hour, 6 to 7. And then there will be an opportunity to field questions from the audience via 3x5 cards or written questions from 7 to 7:30. Is there a website people can go to get additional information?
You know, the best place to go to is on Facebook, and if you just Google it, it's Citizens Climate Lobby Wasatch Back Chapter on Facebook, and you'll find more information there.
All right, Tracy Harden with the Citizens Climate Lobby. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we'll see you. Now,
without further ado, drum roll, please.
Nell Larson joins us. Of course, Nell, among other things, my former co-host here on This Green Earth. First of all, thanks for joining us, Nell.
Yeah, it's
thanks
so good
for being
here.
Okay.
It's like riding a bike. It just comes right back.
Okay, just watch the speed limit.
All right. Take it slow.
Everybody rides too fast around here. All right, take it easy.
For Chris.
And also a former executive director of Swanner Eco Center and Nature Preserve, has now moved on to a position with Los Alamos Labs?
Yeah, Los Alamos National Lab.
National Lab.
Laboratory.
In Los Alamos. And I'm assuming that's where you live?
Yeah. So I'm the program manager for a new program called Enduring Environmental Stewardship there at the lab. We live right there in Los Alamos. So edge of the, kind of up in the Jemez Mountains.
Okay.
Yeah.
We have to honor your request that we really can't talk much about your position and what you're doing there.
Unfortunately, not today.
Not today, maybe another time. But we have a lot to talk about. What I do find potentially interesting is that you moved to another part of the Southwest, you know, much more the truer Southwest. And let's compare and contrast the environmental setting in the New Mexico area with, say, Summit County and the experiences you had here. So overall, I'll let you start. Is there big differences between the two areas? Environmentally, ecologically, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely different ecosystems and different climate, you know. But it's interesting because where I am in northern New Mexico, so that's what I'm most familiar with at this point, right? We're also in the mountains. We're at 7,500 feet. You know, it's a forested
similar
elevation. But it's obviously, you know, more arid, right? So the forests are like ponderosa forests and pinyon juniper forests. But a lot of the issues that I feel like we've started talking about here in Utah, or at least northern Utah more recently, like I think New Mexico maybe had to grapple with these a little bit earlier on. Thinking about, you know, wildfire, that's one that I think about a lot because here we're obviously talking mm-hmm. about that, right? It's mm-hmm. it's a risk we're aware of. In northern New Mexico, a lot of that area has burned, and they've experienced these wildfires that have burned, you know, right into town and burned parts of communities. And so it's not
Ruidosa fire. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah,
Ruidosa fire that happened
just this summer.
This summer.
Yeah.
Not just a fire that burned a lot of structures and a lot of land, acreage, mm-hmm. but then there was a abnormally large rainfall event,
yeah.
which created mudslides and ash slides.
Yeah.
So a real 1-2 punch in that. But that's something that's
yeah.
a challenge there.
Yeah, and it's okay. definitely the concern. Like after. So there have been like a series of wildfires in northern New Mexico there, and I think it was after like the Las Conchas fire. That one is infamous because it like expanded to 61,000 acres in a single day, and it was burning an
wow.
acre a second, and it was,
wow.
you know, catastrophic. And after that went through, then immediately the concern is like, what happens when it rains, right? Mm-hmm. So then
yeah.
trying to you know, put in stormwater structures and anticipate like what will happen when you don't have forests and plants to slow this down. So yeah, it's a significant concern, and the people in the communities there have like been through it and dealt with it and seen it. And so there's a lot of awareness and a lot of like proactive management around the communities and increasingly within the forest to you know.
And probably a lot we could learn based on some of the things that they have been through, especially in the community areas. Like you said, the impact, you know, we often think of the wildfires and the impact it has on the landscape and the environment. And we look up into the charred hills, but not a lot of time do we understand that ripple effect that it
yeah.
has on us with the rain and with displacement of the animals or how the ecosystem is not firing in the way that it
right.
did to help mitigate some things for us, for
yeah.
storms and that way. So I think it's really interesting if
yeah.
Places like ours study what happens after.
Yeah. And one of the things, it's just like an amazing, from somebody who just moved there, right? It's like this amazing visual contrast is literally you'll be driving down a street in town that's maybe on the edge of, you know, open space of, mm-hmm. of some sort. And like one side of the street or one end of the street will be completely like new modern houses. And the other end of the street will be like the older houses that were built in the 1950s with the Manhattan Project. And the reason it's that way is because like one of these, you know, large wildfires like burned part of that area. And so it's just like such a visible contrast in town. And a lot of the people there experienced that. And so there's really no question about like what the risk is related to wildfire. You know, people have it top of mind, I guess.
Nell, is there a lot of non-functional turf in Los Alamos?
There is not. Yeah.
A lot
of people have small amounts of grass.
Yes.
You know,
but,
yeah.
But primarily, it is not only is there no grass.
Yeah.
You know, it's lots of times there's no, I mean, it's just, it's natural state.
Yeah.
Which can look
beautiful.
Beautiful, or some people might look at it and say, like, oh, that's really unattractive. That's just dirt and rocks and what looks like scrub or something. But they get it because water is precious there as well, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Super precious.
Super precious.
Yeah, so I think you see a lot more of, like, the xeriscaping, like
yes.
the desert landscaping with very cool, you know, native grasses and you know, yuccas and all of the neat plants that grow there, like some of similar ones from here. You'll recognize like rabbit brush and different types of sage and cool things like that. But there's kind of a question of like, you know, they're experiencing drought like we are here in Utah and have been. And I feel like there's a little more discussion of like, well, is this a drought or is it more of just a climatic shift? Like, will our ecosystems just be a little different as we move forward? And do we need to like plant accordingly and plan accordingly. So
yeah. Obviously you're only there for literally months, but
yeah.
but chatting with people, are they seeing mm-hmm. a warmer world down there?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that
is warmer days and warmer nights. So how is it unfolding here?
Yeah, yeah. I definitely hear that. I probably talked to people most about it in relation to snow because we had a great snow winter there like we did here. And people would like always make these comments like, oh, this is always how it used to be, or we'd always have at least this much snow. And more recently, it's not, you know, as reliable up on the ski hill or whatever. So and people notice it. Or like the monsoon season, which was, you know, something you could really, really count on to kick in the summer to keep things moist, like, you know, it's not as reliable. Yeah.
Okay.
This year, again, we had a great one. It was amazing. But yeah.
Right, but again, with monsoons brings the threat of thunderstorms and like dry lightning or dry thunderstorms that are common out west. So there's a push pull there. There's pros and cons to that.
Talk about the landscaping a little though. That we had talked about you can finish that thought, but talking about the ponderosa forest and the pinyon pines, I want to learn a little bit more about what's happening.
Yeah.
There.
Okay, so these things like all interrelate perfectly. So the comment about like lightning or dry lightning from thunderstorms. So I was reading a little bit about the like maybe historic fire regime, and it seems like in these ponderosa forests, they were pretty frequent, like less than 10 years, they would come through an area, but it would be a really like, you know, low intensity burn. And so the forest would be relatively open, right? But the understory would, because the understory would like burn, right? Mm-hmm. And then of course, fire suppression kicked in about 100 years ago, similar to so many places. Mm-hmm. And that's what has, you know, it's one contributor to like the large and really hot, intense fires that have been seen in recent years.
Yeah, and it's that concept there is good fire,
right?
Because it does regenerate, and it is a natural state of order. And then when we come in and kind of play a role, sometimes humans can alter this into
as
a place,
well-meaning.
Yes, as well-meaning. Can alter this into a state that down the road is a little bit more detrimental than because it's not acting as naturally as it should.
Right, right. We've like kind of put a halt on those natural processes. And so in combination with the drought and the warmer temps and the slightly more unpredictable weather, it's, you know, seems like it's a challenge for those forests for sure.
And like you said, the knock-on effects to some of the species like the pinyon jay that can be impacted by fire or changes to the population of those of trees, because they have a very specific diet.
Yeah, they
so
rely.
Animals with very specific diets are at more risk to change, climate change or otherwise.
Yeah, and they're linked so specifically. So you mentioned the pinyon jay; they're linked specifically to pinyon pines,
right?
That create like the pinyon nuts or the pine nuts.
I was going to say, what define a pinyon pine? What does that look like? What? How do we define it?
Yeah, it's kind of like how would I describe it? They're trees, but they're sort of scrubby looking trees. And they're kind of like a classic, like I think of like a classic like desert pine. You know, they grow slowly and develop slowly. And they're really linked closely to the pinyon jay, and the pinyon jay is now being considered for a listing under the Endangered Species Act. And you know, the pinyon jay is critical for the pinyon pine because they take the nuts, the seeds, right? They bury those and then they don't retrieve all of them, so they help expand the range and help grow new trees, new plants. But without as much habitat, there aren't as many jays, right? So it's one of those ones that's a tricky cycle. And they're being looked at, I think, for you know, listing as threatened or endangered.
Wow. Okay. We're running out of time. Couple minutes or so. Did you get a chance to go back to the Swanner Eco Center?
Yes. Okay. Well, I've obviously, you know, taken my time walking around the trails, but I just kind of got into town, so I'm meeting up with the Swanner crew later this week. Yeah,
Are you coming back?
Like moving back?
Yeah, so, you know, it's like, you know, I spent 4 months in Los Angeles. It's nice, but...
It was nice, but I've given it a chance. And no, I will be back to visit, that's for sure.
Okay.
But we're liking life in northern New Mexico.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we truly appreciate you taking the time. Have you started a radio show there?
Not yet.
Not yet.
I was going to ask you that. Are you tapping on, do they have an NPR station near there that you can tap on?
That I can jump in on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's
we have
UNN,
a proven model.
There's,
no.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'll send them the link. I'll pitch it.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, when you're down there this winter, we can...
That's oddly enough, I plan on being there in January, February, March, and maybe we can arrange something.
Perfect.
Have a special broadcast from down...
I love that.
I love it.
Going live from Los Alamos.
Well, Nell Larson, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for your questions, jumping in with your questions unsolicited.
Little asterisk, that's, unsolicited.
You can't help yourself.
That's you can't put me in the studio and tell me not to.
You can't put a microphone and not ask questions. I totally get that. So thanks. Hey, is there a website, though, that people can go to learn more about what Los Alamos does with respect to its sustainability programs and environmental programs?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the county has websites where they talk about their programs, and then Los Alamos National Laboratory also has a website, which is, you know, discover.lanl.gov or environment.lanl.gov if you specifically want to look at, like, some of the highlights of environmental work that's happening there. So take a look. Yeah,
all right.
Absolutely.
All right.
We'll dig into that more another time.
You got it. We'll have you back.
That's right.
That's it. Thank you so much, Nell.